We've got another great interview for you guys here on TYT Interviews. It's with Nick Turse. This is When I Speed Through the Bio. He's written for the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, The Nation, and BBC. He's the managing editor of the blog TomDispatch.com, Columbia, Harvard, Columbia, etc. And he wrote the book Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. By the way, Ridenhour Prize, James Harrison Award for Social Justice Journalism, Molly National Journalism Prize. I've been looking for Molly for a long time. I'm glad you found her. Tom Renner Award for Outstanding Crime Reporting, and it goes on and on. Nick, great to have you here on The Young Turks.
Thanks so much for having me on.
All right. So let's talk about your book about Vietnam. Why in the world Vietnam? Why did we go back to that war when we got plenty of wars since?
Yeah, there's plenty of American wars to take your pick from, but I went back to this one because, basically I stumbled upon a set of documents that I could never get out of my head. It was a secret Pentagon task force that was set up in the wake of the My Lai massacre. At My Lai, U.S. troops killed 500 Vietnamese civilians over a period of 4 hours. Mm-hmm. After that massacre was made public, it was a huge scandal for the U.S. military. A directive came down that never again would there be a scandal like this. They had to nip anything like that in the bud. And because of that, a secret task force was set up in the Pentagon to track all war crimes cases to make sure that none of them created a My Lai-type scandal again.
And I don't think I've ever heard of it.
Yeah, well, this task force operated off the books. It never officially existed, but it was run out of the Army Chief of Staff's office, and they collected, many thousands of pages, 30 archival boxes filled with documents, which were reports of massacres, murder, rape, torture, assault, mutilation, horrendous crimes reported by active duty GIs and recently returned veterans.
If it weren't such a hideous thing that they were keeping secret, the whole thing of like, this never existed would have been cool, except what they were hiding was hideous. So how do we find out about it?
Well, I just stumbled upon these records. They were sitting on the archive shelves for years when I found them, but there was no finding aid for them. No one really knew they were there. And an archivist tipped me off to them. Mm-hmm. And I looked at them, I realized they weren't in the literature anywhere, and I said, I had to work with these. And that started.
So it's almost like one of the things you read out of a novel where you stumble upon a clue, and then next thing you know, you're like, wait, these archives are hiding in plain sight. They're right here, and they tell us about all these massacres.
Yeah, I looked at the documents, and I saw that they were atrocities committed by every major U.S. unit that was in Vietnam, every division, every separate brigade, across the entire span of the war, all over the entire country. So I could tell right away that the narrative of isolated incidents that we've been told for years, that My Lai was a one-off event, was far from the case, and I knew that the military knew this. They had the records right there.
So you say massacres, so give me a couple of examples so I understand better. So what would we do on a regular basis?
Well, there are a number of massacres that are in these records where, troops would go into a village, round up the people. There's one that always comes to mind. It took place on February 8th, 1968. A U.S. Army unit went into a small hamlet, rounded up 19 women and children. A lieutenant got on the radio and asked his commanding officer, a West Point trained captain, what should I do with these people? And the captain called back on the radio and said, you know the order that came down from higher headquarters this morning, kill anything that moves. And as a result, 19 women and children were killed in cold blood and the unit left. And no one would have been the wiser except that there was one lone whistleblower from the unit. I ended up talking with him years later and he told me 30 seconds after that massacre took place, he vowed to make it public. He did all he could, but he could just never get traction on his allegations. He went to the press, he was on the radio, he wrote an article, but it went nowhere. And what he didn't know was that the Army investigated these allegations and they corroborated everything that he had said. But then they took no action and they just buried the records away.
So let's talk about that. So why didn't the press give it more attention? I mean, My Lai Massacre got a ton of attention. Why not that one?
Well, it was never made, this veteran made it public, and it even generated a small article in the Los Angeles Times at one point, but it was hidden on the back pages, and massacre was in scare quotes. It was, no one stepped forward to back up his version, so it was basically a he said, this one veteran against the military.
So the military knows that it's true, right. And they say, oh, nonsense.
That's right. I mean, this veteran went public at something called the Winter Soldier Investigation in 1971, where 100 American veterans came together and gave testimony. But the Nixon administration, they had sent operatives into Winter Soldier to monitor the events. The reports were sent back to Henry Kissinger's office, and the White House put out the word that these weren't real veterans. They were fake veterans. They'd made up these stories. And the smears that were out there about these veterans, cast them in a bad light, and people weren't going to believe it.
Isn't that amazing? Like, Republicans like Nixon, who are talking about supporting the troops even back then, I can't believe the liberal hippie Democrats, et cetera, maligning the troops when they came back from Vietnam. Meanwhile, they're running secret smear campaigns against the troops that actually saw what we did to make sure that they destroy their reputations.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, there's always this idea that that the anti-war movement in America was anti-veteran and veterans were spit upon, and I'm sure it happened at some point or another. But really, if you look at the history of the anti-war movement, the veterans, were real leaders by the early 1970s. They were lionized. These were the people that were at the front of anti-war parades, and they were front and center at gatherings because they had seen firsthand what was going on in Vietnam, and they were willing to speak out.
That's their government proverbially spitting in their face by destroying their reputations and smearing them, et cetera. You know, the more you read about history, unfortunately, the more you come to realize what a huge percentage of it is simply propaganda. Propaganda put out by whatever the government wants at that time. So in this case, about the reality, why kill everything that moves?
Well, I try in my book to tie together a lot of different reasons. There was a whole confluence of reasons that caused this to be the case. There were things from racism, which was inculcated in troops during their basic training, to the very metrics that the war was run on. This wasn't a classic war where you had two armies facing off across a defined battlefield like World War I. The U.S. wasn't trying to take territory or capture an enemy capital. And the Pentagon was fumbling around for a metric to show they were winning the war. And what they seized upon was the body count. The idea was that you could kill your way to victory. And you were supposed to be killing enemy troops. But troops in the field learned very quickly that command wasn't that discerning about what bodies were turned in, as long as they were Vietnamese. And a shorthand became very quickly, if it's dead in Vietnamese, it's VC, that is Viet Cong, or the guerrillas that the Americans were fighting. And there were all sorts of incentives to produce bodies. You could get a three-day pass to a beach resort for a dead body, or extra beer, better food, lighter duty at base camp.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and there were a lot of veterans who told me they called it the incentivization of death. They said it really messed with their heads. Everything they'd been told from youth that killing was wrong was turned on its head. Suddenly, if you kill somebody, you get extra beer, and you were encouraged to do it.
And they didn't, they turned in a woman's body, a 13-year-old's body, who cares? Here, welcome to your beer.
Yeah, basically, troops were told that anybody in quote-unquote black pajamas was fair game. This is what the guerrillas wore, loose-fitting black clothing. But it's also what all the peasant farmers in Vietnam wore, just ordinary people in the countryside. So black pajamas became a reason for killing someone, or taking evasive action, is what they called it. That's running away. When you have heavily armed, foreign, basically teenagers who come into your village and start burning down homes, you're apt to try and run away from them. Once you do, the military's rules of engagement made it perfectly permissible to target and kill these people, no matter who they were.
It's so sad that what goes around comes around in not the right way, but the wrong way, meaning that, like, what's new is what's old is new again, right? So now we say if we kill someone with a drone strike in Pakistan or Yemen, they must have been a terrorist by definition, right? That's literally, it's an article out of the New York Times. Sure. And their point is that unless proven otherwise after they've already been killed, if they're an adult male, roughly, right, and we've killed 16-year-olds, 15-year-olds, et cetera, they're to be considered terrorists by definition. So is this basically a playbook straight out of Vietnam?
Yeah, we're talking about the same type of thing and the same terminology, military age males. You hear this over and over again when you read transcripts of drone attacks. Yeah, you see that this is a reason that people are targeted. They fit a profile, basically being young and male and armed in the backlands of Pakistan or Yemen, where, you know, almost all young men are armed for one reason or another. But it's a pretext for killing. And you saw the same exact thing in Vietnam, military age males.
Right. In Yemen, they're the second most armed nation in the world per capita. Of course, we're number one. So if we use our own logic in the U.S., we'd kill nearly everyone in the country. Military-aged males that have weapons on them, I don't know if we'd take out 50 million, 100 million guys in the U.S., but when it comes to Yemen, they don't really count. So that goes back to your racism point. In Vietnam, I mean, I don't think we were in Vietnam, and if you're the expert, I'm not, because of racism, but was there a dismissiveness to the body count because who cares, they're Asian, or what was it?
Yeah, you know, this is something that, I interviewed hundreds of veterans for this, and I heard again and again from them the same types of things, and I apologize for using these slurs, but I was told that as soon as they got to boot camp, they were told, you never call them Vietnamese, you call them gooks or dinks, slants, slopes, rice eaters, anything to take away their humanity, anything to make it easier to kill. And there are many veterans I talked to, minority veterans, who would say, you know, I realized right away that this was the same racism that I faced at home, and they vowed that they would never use these slurs. But then they said, you know, they heard it over and over again during boot camp and advanced infantry training, and when they got their in-country training in Vietnam, and then you get out in the field, and everybody calls all the Vietnamese gooks. And they said, you know, they just found themselves being, you know, they're immersed in that, and they just started using the language, and then they started adopting that mindset. And they said it made it very easy to kill. In Vietnam, there's a shorthand. They called it the MGR, the mere gook rule. And the idea was that the Vietnamese weren't real people. They were subhuman, mere gooks who could be abused or even killed at will without any repercussions.
As you outline how the military works, we've seen this in all, I don't know about all militaries, but certainly most militaries through most of world history. You dehumanize, you make it easy to kill, you make it robotic to kill, your enemies, the bad guys, they're not individual human beings, and only metric is body count, right? Yeah. I feel like reading all the way back to the Mongols, same thing, right? Body count. So it doesn't give a lot of hope because it seems like, first of all, let's acknowledge what an incredibly stupid tactic that is if you're actually trying to win, especially against an insurgency, right? So whether it's Afghanistan or Vietnam, it's never gonna work if the country you're liberating, you're annihilating, right? I mean, anybody with half a mind could tell you that. Yet, because of the way the military is structured, it seems like we do that every time anyway. So then that makes me ask, is there any hope for getting military conflicts right in the future?
It's a difficult question to answer. Certainly this country, you know, hasn't had the right formula, at least since World War II. I mean, we've had either stalemate wars or losses since then. And it's really, you know, again and again, alienating the population. You know, I went to Vietnam, I did, you know, hundreds and hundreds of interviews there. And, you know, people told me that, you know, sometimes the Americans did come through and give them soap or candy to their kids. But then the next time they came through, they burned down all the homes. They shot farmers in the fields. They never knew, you know, which American troops would show up. But the ones, of course, that they remember are the ones who destroyed their lives.
Yeah, the soap doesn't help you much after they shoot and kill your mom.
No.
How are we ever going to win in Vietnam if we made everyone the enemy? It is so profoundly stupid, yet our leadership kept on going as if that was a brilliant move. And today, I mean, again, look, it's more limited, right, because the drone strikes kill less people. But we recently killed, you know, over a dozen people in a wedding procession and wounded dozens. They're not likely to be on our side if, like Al-Qaeda, we blow up weddings.
Yeah, you know, the firepower in today's wars isn't used at the same scale as Vietnam, so there's less killing of civilians. But, you know, still, we do kill civilians on a regular basis. It's ongoing. And, you know, we never think about what it's like for, you know, someone to live with a drone flying overhead 24 hours a day. you hear that lawnmower sound, you know that at any moment a missile can come down, blow up your neighbor's home, maybe your home. This is something I think we don't consider what exactly that must be like and what it does to people and what it makes them think of this country.
Since you have the perspective of Vietnam and the degree to which we did mass killings, right, have things gotten a little better in the sense that at least we don't kill as many people as many times?
Yeah, the toll in Vietnam is immense. 2 million civilian dead, the best estimates we have, 5.3 million wounded. That's a tremendous toll. In these wars, I think it's been much less because of the way that firepower is applied. There isn't the carpet bombing that we saw in Southeast Asia. Artillery isn't unleashed on the countryside in the same ways. That being said, it's really tough to get a handle on just what the civilian toll has been. My day job is as a national security reporter, and I spent about a year and a half trying to get an embed in Afghanistan to look at something the military calls their CIVCAS system. They set this up around 2007, 2008, a way to track civilian casualties and mitigate them. I would get just so far in the process, and then they would bar me from going to take a look at it firsthand. They claim that the system worked, but they wouldn't let anyone take a look at it to verify their claims. And they don't want anyone to see even the numbers that they have. They won't release them to the public. So I'm afraid that it might be 40 years from now, and there might be a journalist or historian sitting in a seat very much like this, finally laying bare what the toll has been for these recent wars.
One of the criticisms of your book has been that you're focused too much on the individual soldiers and not enough on the carpet bombing and all that. How do you respond to that?
Well, I really try and make it clear in the book that most Vietnamese weren't killed in My Lai-style massacres. Most weren't rounded up and gunned down. There's only so much killing a squad or a company or even an entire battalion can do. Most of the Vietnamese, and I try and show, died as a result of command policy, and that is the heavy application of firepower on areas that the military knew were filled with civilians. They basically blanketed the countryside with heavy bombing and almost random artillery shelling. They made it inevitable that tremendous numbers of Vietnamese would be killed, and this is how most of them died.
Every time we talk about this, I'm amazed that if you're the president, whether it's Lyndon Johnson or Richard Nixon, that you wouldn't say, you effing morons, why are you killing all the people we're supposed to try to get on our side? Why in the world would they support us? And how in the world can we win this war if we don't have the local population's support, if they all despise us? Weren't Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon relatively smart people? Why didn't they ever say that?
It's a very good question. The military only has so many tools in its toolkit. And when Vietnam came around, basically they had one method at their disposal. It was firepower. They talked every so often about the civilian half of the war. But really, as the reporter, Newsweek reporter Jonathan Schell said, about 99% was the military half, and that 1% was the civilian half of the war. There was very little that was put into actually winning hearts and minds. What the military had was weaponry, and whenever they encountered failure in Vietnam, the only thing they had to turn to was more and more firepower, and that's what they tried.
And of course, ironically, all we had to do was invade them with Levi's and McDonald's and give it a couple of decades. They were going to come around anyway. We needlessly killed all those millions of people. So one last thing. When you talk to the veterans, and you said you talked to hundreds of them, right? Yeah. What's their take on it now? Do they feel like, I got to live with myself. I did what I was told or what was necessary. Or has this caused profound psychological damage on them as well?
Well, as you might imagine, I've heard responses all across the spectrum. There were some veterans that I talked to that were completely unrepentant, said they thought that what they had done in Vietnam was right, it was for the good of the country, and if they were put in a Vietnam-type situation again, they would do exactly the same thing. But that was the exception to the rule. There's one story that always sticks with me, and I think it encapsulates what I heard most often. And it was one veteran that I talked to. It was a marathon, 4, maybe 5 hour phone call. And he told me over and over again how some of the best times of his life were in Vietnam because the bonds he had there, the friendships were the strongest that he'd have before or since. And he went on and on like this for a long time. He had a big booming laugh. And then He quieted down towards the end of our phone call, and he said, I want to tell you a story. And he said, you know, we went into this hamlet one day, and we started burning it down. And he said that was standard operating procedure for his unit. They burned down all the villages they went through. And he said, there was this one GI, and he just started burning a home, and a woman came up and started grabbing on his arm, yelling at him, and quite obviously because her home and all her possessions were going up in flames. And he said that the GI just pushed her off. But she came back again a second time. He pushed her again, a third time, same thing. The fourth time that she came back, he took his M16 rifle and hit her squarely in the nose with the butt of the rifle. He broke her nose. There was blood everywhere. She was screaming. And he said that the GI just turned around and walked away laughing. Then he paused for a beat, and he said, I guess you know where this is going. And he said, you know, I was that GI. He said, at the time, I didn't think anything of it. But in all these years since, that's all I can think of. And this vision, you know, he said it had encapsulated his entire wartime experience. And it haunted him for 40 years. And that's mostly what I encountered, men who had done terrible things when they were really boys, 18, 19, 20 years old, and put into almost untenable circumstances. And now they've been grappling with these horrible acts that they had committed for 40 years after.
See, honestly, I didn't see where that was going. I'm not that bright. But it reminds me of the incredibly dumb things I used to do when I was 18 and 19. Sure. And God, if you'd put me in the middle of a war, you know, and as we do these kids, and you had brainwashed and said, they're just gooks, kill everything that moves, title of your book, right? God knows what any 18 or 19-year-old does after that kind of brainwashing.
Yeah, it was really sobering to me when I encountered these guys, and I thought about the exact same things. Put in that situation as a teenager, I think all of us would have to seriously consider, you know, what we would do.
The trick, I think, is to not get into those situations. And we have not really mastered that trick here in the U.S. We keep stumbling into one after another, and all we see is nails because all we have is a hammer.
Yeah, it's our national pastime almost.
Unfortunately. All right, the book is Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. Obviously incredibly enlightening. Nick Turse, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.